What's up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to a delayed Armchair Producers episode. Who really cares anymore? The Russian bots.
I'm sure. Anybody counting? I'm not counting.
I'm not going to bother counting anymore. Welcome to the newest episode where George doesn't give a fuck. Woohoo!
Did we ever give a fuck? That was kind of our whole shtick.
I tried giving a fuck.
Yeah, well, my fucks didn't give a fuck about us, so who cares?
Yeah, that's true. So, how are you, Mr. Travis Croft, my faithful companion through life, the universe, and everything?
Wow, it's 42. Should feel like that should be the answer. I'm fine and dandy. We're in a newly sort of lockdown state again. You know, you just can't trust people to do the right thing anymore. There's less options to do things. So, you know, I don't go out much anyway, so it's really not much of a huge difference to me. But it does give us more time to watch new stuff, play new stuff, and to give our thoughts to the Russian bots out there who are keen to hear what we think about.
How else are they going to recreate us as Russian robots if they don't have hundreds and thousands of hours of us just talking crap?
Well, yeah, if they haven't done it yet, they could be in trouble.
Well, yeah, it's the only true path to immortality. And if they're not on it, then they're behind.
Well, keep it on it, Vlad. You know, you're up for election in November. Not in your country, but, you know.
Yep. Now, let's get to the meat and potatoes of the show, shall we? We are generally a weekly show for anyone who is just randomly catching us for some reason now. Welcome. We talk about whatever the fuck we want to talk about, usually about movies, TV shows, video games, music, a little bit of wrestling, theater as well from time to time.
Modern society, the usual.
Yeah, you know, the usual chit chat, you know, the water cooler moments of the week.
That's why we're going to be talking about a film from 1987 this week.
Yes, absolutely. It is all relevant. Of course, a movie with Robert De Niro and Mickey Rourke. The two biggest stars in Hollywood at the moment, I would say. You know.
That said, the number one film at the US box office this week, number one and two films at the US box office this week. I'd like to have a guess what the number one film at the box office this week was.
Oh, I heard something about this. Jurassic Park, right?
That's Jurassic Park, but narrowly beat out Jaws.
So, it's nice to know that even in lockdown, Steven Spielberg rules the blockbuster roost.
But only just beat out a 45-year-old film. So, we're actually quite with it, the fact that we're talking about films.
Yeah. We sit nicely between those two outlets as well, you know, the 90s and the one from 40 years ago. Yeah, Angel Heart sits right in there.
We're working our way forward, sort of.
roundabout way.
So did you get to what? You finally got around to watching it, I imagine.
I didn't get a chance to watch it because I have been inundated with a new job, and that has consumed all of my time, and I've been coming home. My body is in crash mode. It's like 2.5 months of doing nothing, and then suddenly, I'm doing 46-hour days.
46-hour days sound kind of full on.
Yeah, that's kind of nuts.
Working hard out in northern suburbs.
And yeah, it's crazy. I'm having to work my left hand, my left side, my right side, and both my feet to catch up on those hours, man.
Like that poor Yorkshireman sketch by the Monty Python, you know.
Yeah,
Yorkshire. Exactly. I had to get to work at 3 a.m. 2 hours before I got up. Pay 6 months to the mill owner for the right to work there. Come home and get fresh to sleep with my dad's belt, if we were lucky.
Oh, you had a belt.
Yeah, wake night dreaming of belts. Well, you have seen the film, so
I have.
You might remember a little bit, so we should jump in if any Russian bots who are interested.
Yeah, let's get into it.
Angel Heart. So we chose this one with a rather tenuous connection. It's written by William Hjortsberg, who wrote Legend, which is the film we talked about most recently on the podcast. Yeah. It is directed by Alan Parker, He's a name that probably won't seem uber familiar to people, though he was quite an accomplished director in his day.
Oh, yeah.
Mississippi Burning, Midnight Express, The Commitments in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
He directed stuff for Pink Floyd. He directed the 96 Madonna film, Evita. He directed Angel's Ashes in the 90s, which was a famous one.
Yeah.
He seems like he's giving it away now. So highly accomplished director, if not necessarily a household name.
Yeah.
And as you noted, it did star, well, who were two of the biggest stars in the world at the time.
Yeah.
Rourke, sort of a young, up-and-coming, hot young thing.
Yeah.
And Robert De Niro, I guess, by that point in time, was the established pro with a big reputation behind him. What a pretty, pretty young man Mickey Rourke was.
He was before his boxing, wasn't he?
Before his boxing days and, I guess, substance abuse, I'm guessing. I remember you read about him being compared to a young Marlon Brando, or, you know, and you that's can kind of see it.
Yeah.
Maybe not acting. Well, he was a fine actor. He remains, I imagine, a fine actor. I haven't seen him in anything for a long time. What is Mickey up to? I think he was really hot there for 5 minutes.
Well, he became friends with Robert Rodriguez on the set of Once Upon a Time in Mexico. And then, of course, he had his big comeback in Sin City as Marv. And he was also,
of course, the wrestler.
Yeah, he was in The Wrestler for Aronofsky, which got him his Oscar. Did he win the Oscar?
I don't think he did. I think he got nominated.
Yeah, he got nominated. And of course, he was, well, I say of course, it was a little, one of those, it was right in that period where they were trying to make sort of like young adult action movies. And he was the bad guy in one which had Jason Pettifer and Ewan McGregor. And it was kind of funny because Jason Pettifer, I think it's Jason or James Pettifer or something like that. He's like supposed to be this 16, 17 year old boy who's really good at sort of like the extreme sports, like BMX biking and skiing and things like that. And his uncle, played by Ewan McGregor, is secretly a spy and he's been kind of grooming his nephew for this for ages. And it's not a good movie. And for some reason, this 16, 17 year old boy has got a deeper voice than his uncle, who's in his 40s. And like, seems weird.
You look at his IMDb page, he's still working. He's got two, three new films out throughout this year. He was in two films last year, none of which I've heard of. So it looks like he's gone back to the land of direct-to-video.
Yeah.
So Angel Heart, a private investigator, is hired by a man who calls himself Lewis Cipher to track down a singer named Johnny Favorite. But the investigation takes an unexpected and somber turn. I think you noted when we talked about this in the last podcast that is a relatively not terribly descriptive synopsis of a plot. And I would tend to agree with you having seen it now.
Yeah.
It's quite a bit deeper than that. This is, so I think the reason we chose this is because we were sick of watching garbage. And this is really quite good. I really quite enjoyed this. It's very noir.
Yes.
It does take very great inspiration from a sort of 1940s, 30s and 40s film noir. He's the stereotypical private dick, you know.
He's that gumshoe.
World-worn and, hard drinking and hard fighting, again, it's a fairly typical sort of detective noir story of, the down on his luck detective who takes on that case purely because it's the money's too good to say no to, only to find himself in way over his head.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of where I sort of found the story started with me was that, it's good. You can see it's well made. I mean, it looked amazing. You had Alan Parker, I feel like he really evoked that sort of 30s and 40s aesthetic, especially in the scene set in New York.
Yeah.
And then you sort of, this is going to be a fairly standard style, detective story, but it really takes a left-hand turn when the story relocates from New York to New Orleans.
Yeah.
Or Louisiana. I think it was New Orleans, wasn't it?
I think it was New Orleans, yeah.
And all of a sudden we're talking about voodoo shit. And then you kind of like, okay, is this going to be kind of a really standard sort of plot element of like a bit of a red herring to sort of throw you off where he comes back to find the bad guy's really a gangster or something stupid like that. But, oh, no, this film does not do anything by half. Mm. It fully commits to that that new angle, and I'm not going to spoil it in case people want to see it. And I would say if you can find a copy, I think it's available on your usual streaming services, your Google Plays, your Apple Movies, and Windows, Microsoft, whatever their version is, Windows Store. Worth a look. Where it ends up is certainly a very, very long way from where I thought it was going to go. I think a lot of clever people will probably see the twist coming ahead of time. I know you in particular, your superpower of going, oh, here's this and that, and this will all happen at the end within the first 10 minutes or something. And, you as in that guy in the first 5 minutes of a Sixth Sense going, I bet he's dead. I was just sort of on for a ride. It's not necessarily a huge shock at the end. I mean, but
I think it winds you up for the kind of reveal at the end really well. And I think it's one of those rare movies with that twist factor that even if you read it early on, it's still really engaging because it's so character based. The emotional roller coaster that he goes through kind of getting through that twist himself as a character, you kind of go, you know what? Yeah, I saw that coming, but damn, that was still good.
Yeah, no, and it paid off, right? Well, didn't say telegraph, did it? It stepped you up to it, right? So to give a bit of plot, like we have Mickey Rourke. He's, as I said, the down on his luck detective in New York. He gets a weird request to do an investigation for Robert De Niro's character, whose name is Cypher. And or he's the lawyer played by Dan Florek, who Law and Order SVU fans will recognize because he was in that for a long time. Captain Hagen or something. I can't remember his character's name. He was on Law and Order. He's just kind of playing a lawyer now instead of a cop. And as he's tasked to find his person, Johnny Favorite, and we start off going, sort of tracking his path, and then I'm not going to give too much away, but every sort of very key sort of person he meets, or almost every key person he meets who can sort of give him some information about where Johnny might be, somehow seems to end up dead.
Yeah.
And in fairly gruesome ways.
Yeah.
It starts, you sort of wonder what the hell's going on. The police are looking for him. He's got voodoo shit sort of out and looking for goons attacking him randomly at, fisheries. Guys turn up and beat the shit out of him while he's trying to buy some fish or something. I don't want to give too much away. Like, honestly, it sort of escalates from there, but you sort of like, the moments you sort of do have that really cool, what the fuck is going on moments. But when they start to really give you big pieces of story towards the end, it steps it nicely. As you said, it winds you up. It's not just sort of go, oh, surprise. Whereas a film today probably would do that. It would probably maybe drop some very subtle hints and then just smash you in the face with it in the final 5 minutes or something. This film steps you up to it. Whereas, you're right, like we have a pretty good idea about what the twist is going to be about Mickey Rourke's character. Maybe not quite so much about Robert De Niro's character, but you're probably not going to be hugely shocked because we sort of got some dropped hints along the way. But when it happens, it's done so well. The twist and the revelation about Robert De Niro's character and his motivations is so beautifully shot. Geez, De Niro is so good in this. He's incredible.
He so underplays it to perfection. It's awesome. He's so quiet. And the little movements, like rolling the egg and stuff to crack it. There's so much character in every little thing that he does, and he's just always so quiet and kind of reserved with his analysis and conversation. And you can feel him kind of weighing every single word that he talks before it comes out of his mouth, as if sort of like every single one of these words means everything.
And it all comes together at the end. There's a particular Rolling Stones song that actually reminds me of his character in this film, which I won't mention because that'll give it away. But it's one of the most beautiful depictions of this type of character I've seen before. And he's a, and I would say a deeply, deeply underrated De Niro performance. Like, we think of De Niro today as being, he's done some shit really in his later life, right? I mean, bad grandpa and that kind of thing. And some of his more recent films haven't been particularly memorable. But other than, you know, Joker, and some might say The Irishman, I haven't got around to seeing yet. But this is one that people don't talk about. And I just looked up, he didn't get a particularly large swathe of nominations. There was no high profile nominations for this film, but wow, it's actually kind of, the performance kind of reminds me a little bit of his performance in Casino. Where not necessarily he's not Don Corleone, right? He's not the badass from Heat, right? He's going around shooting people. He's kind of the functionary of a mob, right? He's the numbers guy. He's softly spoken. He doesn't take any shit necessarily, but he's not the loud and angry and aggressive type. Isn't that what Joe Pesci kind of does in that film? But but I kind of see little pieces of that character in this earlier film. And if you are a fan of De Niro and you haven't seen this one, you want to get on board, because it's a truly wonderful performance in and an interesting film, shall we say. And I mean,
I don't think that they would make this kind of movie anymore today.
It'd be rare. I can't imagine this has a very, very broad appeal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even just kind of the merging of the two themes, I think that it would either end up being some kind of weird kind of comic book adaptation kind of thing with an established base, or kind of like, I guess Joker is a little bit like it, where it's all about that escalation and the twisting of the character slowly but surely throughout. But this is even more niche than something like Joker, where it's about a DC Comics villain, but because of their prestige around it, it got a much bigger audience. This
film was a flop, I think it's fair to say. It had a $17 million budget.
Yep.
And Box Office Mojo says it was a $17 million, $185,000 gross domestically. Doesn't have any international figures. So it would have wanted to do very well internationally.
Yeah.
For them to make money back in the late 80s. And it's not necessarily a fondly remembered film, I think you'd say. Most people I've mentioned it to over the last couple of weeks have gone, whoa.
Yeah, I don't even think it's remembered, whether fondly or not. It's because it's definitely, I don't think you could levy against it saying, oh, it's a shit movie. You're like, no, it's
not. No, it's absolutely not a shit movie. It's just a very strange movie.
Yeah.
The one thing the more modern film it did remind me of was Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, which was the Nicolas Cage film.
The Werner Herzog.
Werner Herzog. And so definitely, that's probably also because that was set in New Orleans, but it had that sort of weird, otherworldly sort of vibe to it, and sort of truly strange sort of goings on. I really don't think I actually understood what that film was about.
But I don't think anyone working on it did.
Madness kind of vibe going on in that film.
Yeah.
And that was why it kind of reminded me of you, potentially. I don't know when it was. Herzog directed the first one, and he directed the remake, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
I think he did.
1992, the original. So potentially it could have been influenced by Angel Heart. You never, I don't know. So he didn't direct the original. It was by Abel Ferreira. In today's list of things you didn't need to know. But the remake's worth watching. It's fucking weird.
Yeah. It's I haven't had a chance to see Mandy yet. And I feel like that is the most recent of the legendary Nicolas Cage roles. Before that, Port of New Orleans is probably the last great bombastic Nicolas Cage role.
It was pretty out there. Nicolas was worked so much. I'm loath to say a whole lot more about this film, lest I I spoil it, but I mean, for one of the Russian bots, you might be able to find a bootleg copy somewhere. But yeah, Angel Heart, I was very satisfied with this. It was a really weird journey. And I guess in the way most good films make you feel, it hasn't left me.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, I couldn't wait for Legend to end. And I couldn't wait to stick the boots into Top Gun. Because I didn't like that. But this one was kind of like, I wasn't necessarily saying I was sad it was over, but it was more like, I'm glad we weren't recording that night, because I definitely needed some time to digest this film and have a think about what it was that I enjoyed about it. And it's stuck in my head now. So
this movie was possibly the biggest influence kind of genre and style and storytelling wise for Vaughn. That blending of the otherworldly and the detective noir kind of thing in the, it's like a city you've heard legend of, you know, like New Orleans. Whenever someone talks about New Orleans, you usually think of the Hollywoodized ideology of voodooism and the super spirituality and that kind of stuff, or you also think of flooding and horrible stuff like that. But you've got, it's got that kind of, just saying the name of New Orleans, you instantly get an idea, you get this, it's got a character to it.
I don't know if you've ever seen Easy Rider.
Yeah.
Again, I think that's maybe the first film I recall seeing that had that really, it could have been done earlier, and I'm certainly not a film historian. But, you know, like, it really deep dived into that kind of weird sort of spiritual sort of otherworldliness of New Orleans, which was done very well in that film. And, it's been, ripped off, I think, you have to say, for the last 50 years, mostly poorly. But I think there's the odd film that kind of pulls it off really well. But you're right, it comes across as sort of seedy and sweaty and humid. You get the real feel of the city and the area. Not that I've been there, but you know, I can imagine. And you know, you get that sort of spooky, you know, spookiness of voodoo, which for a belief system that's kind of in the butt of a lot of jokes. And again, it's been done to fucking death over the years to see a film pull it off so well. And then again, this could actually be one of those films that's kind of the Godfather effect. It's become cliche because of films like this. Far less skilled filmmakers just rip it off and, you know, slot it in as a convenient plot element.
I think that's one of the things, you know, you're talking about the feel of it, and it's got an atmosphere around it, the movie and the way that it portrays both New York and New Orleans, that you feel that atmosphere almost physically on you. It's not just emotional feeling of, oh, this is dingy and dark, because it's not just dingy and dark. There's this sort of like dark sexuality to the New Orleans stuff, bringing in the voodooism and just the life that they capture on screen of this just people living their life and just doing their thing. It feels tactile as well.
It does. And I think that's a great compliment to the filmmakers.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That the production design was so well put together, and you know, I think it's set in the '60s, and they really, really pulled this one off.
100%.
It's kind of sad, you know, Mickey Rourke, you look at this and go, well, you can almost see hints of a young James Dean there sometimes. Hints of a young Marlon Brando, and yeah, he didn't really go on with it.
Yeah. I'm just looking at who did the cinematography for this movie, and it's a guy called Michael Sarrazin, and he has he knows how to shoot a pretty movie. He has been the DOP for War of the Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, Gravity. He did Mowgli, which was what's his name? The guy who played Gollum. Andy Serkis. Yeah, the Andy Serkis one has got a lot of flaws, but looks awesome. All Good Things. He's had his hand in a lot of very, very beautifully shot movie. So he definitely knows his craft. So congratulations to Michael years after the fact. But
a lazy 33 years later, he got his well done, mate.
He's been waiting for us.
Exactly. We should send him in. We should see if he's on Twitter and not sitting. I just saw it and I thought it was tops. But interestingly, this week, I was looking at on Twitter this week, and I think it's the 10th anniversary, maybe, of At World's End, the Edgar Wright film, the last of a Cornetto trilogy.
Really? 10 years?
10 years, yeah.
Oh, shit.
And so Edgar Wright was talking about it on Twitter, and people were going, oh, I really liked how all the cars were voxels or something like that, and that sort of meant this to me. But, you know, he's like, oh, that's what I thought aliens would drive if they came to a planet. Then, like, some guy was like, oh, but I noticed that it's at the posters on the walls are all the voxel or something. And he's like, wow, yeah, I totally did that on purpose, and you're the first person who's ever mentioned that to me. And I'm like, wow, that had to be a pretty good feeling for that bloke who recorded that. So, you know, sometimes, many years on, it can still be, these sort of things can still be appreciated. Absolutely. By the film.
A compliment is never lost in time.
And what a fine film that was. I'm going to have to go back and watch that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Move it on. Next week, the next podcast, depending on George's very busy schedule, it will be The King of Comedy.
The King of Comedy. Now, what is the connection?
That is,
for those Robert who don't know, yeah,
in The King of Comedy. So De Niro is our link to this one.
Mm-hmm.
He's a bit sneaky. We did talk about this last time. I've always kind of wanted to see it. Everybody's kind of said, oh, Joker draws inspiration for this so very much.
Mm.
I've never seen it, so I'm curious to check it out. It's kind of sad that there are Scorsese films there I haven't seen.
Well, he's done quite a few, and some of them are hard to get through. Like, you know, the
Japanese missionary one.
Yeah, Silence. Yeah.
Yeah,
and the one with Willem Dafoe as Jesus Christ.
The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yes, that's hard to get through.
Well, we'll see how we go with the King of Comedy. Hopefully, it's not hard to get through. I'm just sort of curious. It's got a 7.8 on IMDb. It's got a 73 Metascore. So, hopefully, we're playing in safe territory again.
Yeah. Yeah, but considering you know, the dross that we have gone through to get to this point, I think we're earned a little bit of quality.
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. That's kind of why I did it. Like, I want two good films in a row. I want to go back to fucking, you know, legend level shite.
A week after next, the Katherine Heigl movie.
Yay! You're gonna find a connection. There we go. We'll find a connection between The King of Comedy, Katherine Heigl. Don't tempt me. I'll do it. I'm in isolation still, sort of. I have a lot of spare time. But moving on, I wanted to talk about a new film. It's actually out at the cinemas in Australia as of, I think, this week, last week.
What is cinema?
Yes, it is a place where people congregate to watch films. It's a funny concept, but it's taken off. Okay. Actual cinema. So actual cinemas are actually showing the 2019 film, The Assistant. Now, my friend Susie is watching. Susie might actually enjoy this, and enjoy is a strong word, might be interested in this film. This has been called the hashtag Me Too film.
Okay.
So a searing look at a day in the life of an assistant to a powerful executive. As Jane follows her daily routine, she grows increasingly aware of the insidious abuse that threatens every aspect of her position. So this is a fairly small film. It stars Julia Garner as Jane, who is the titular assistant. I wasn't familiar with her. She's been in a few things. She's in Ozark. That's probably which I'm not. I haven't got around to watching. She was in The Americans. Jeez, I should know that. But anyway, I don't recognize it.
I don't know anyone involved in this.
No, there's no big stars involved. And that's one of the interesting factors. It's written and directed by Kitty Green, who I think is better known for documentaries If I'm not mistaken. So casting JonBenet, Ukraine is not a brothel. I think this is a, she's probably better known in the documentary side of things. I can't say this is a feature debut, but this film, when I say the hashtag Me Too film, really the story of this film, I think it draws pretty liberally from what one would say is the story of someone like Harvey Weinstein.
Okay.
So we have an unnamed and unseen, bigwig. I can't remember the director of a CEO. I can't remember what she actually calls him in the film. And she is one of his assistants. And her sort of role, we sort of see it's very much shot in almost a fly on the wall style, almost in a documentary kind of style of doing it, where we see sort of vignettes of different days, parts of her days through her time working as the assistant. And we see her sort of start to get her head around what's really going on in her boss's office and in her world. Mm. And the kind of thing she's kind of playing, an accomplice to.
Okay.
And you sort of see her escalate her journey as she sort of starts to eat at her conscience to the point where she tries to address them and it's shut down in an incredibly disturbing way. So when I say it starts to eat at her conscience, we don't have any super cheesy scenes of her talking to her mom or her, gay best friend or something going, oh my God, like in something like, The Devil Wears Prada. You know, sort of really clunky expositional scenes. It's all done, with just facial expressions, really, and reactions. And so things like a bunch of executives go into the boss's office to have a meeting. Someone goes to sit down on the couch in his office and people's like, ha ha, don't you know, you never sit on that couch. She has to clean up things in that office, not often you see people Windexing a couch. And the night after, the morning after a late night meeting, we see her stocking a medicine cabinet type thing in her boss's office with injecty syringes full of stuff that, shall we say, addresses particular male problems that, occur later in life. They can inhibit certain parts of one's intimate life. The injectable version of Viagra, in other words, I don't know what the exact title of it was, which apparently was a thing that Harvey Weinstein did have in his office, was like boxes of his shit to inject.
Wow.
And so you're like, you can just sort of see her sort of facial expressions and her reactions to certain situations where she'll be like, she'll be showing young, beautiful women into his office and stuff like that, and or getting him to meet him and organizing appointments. It's really nicely done. It's certainly not an easy watch. It's shot in such stark lighting. I love the lighting in this film. It's almost like it's brutal sort of white, fluorescent light is just sort of, shining throughout the film, or sort of throughout it. You can sort of mirrors her ability to sort of inability, shall I say, to sort of continue to not see what she's doing. And you sort of in the conflict between her going, she wants to be a producer, and people saying, stick it out. Again, a little bit like Devil Wears Prada in a way, stick this out for long enough. If you can put up with this dickhead for long enough, you'll go where you want to go to, but the compromises she has to make in her head to get with her conscience to sort of put up with the things that she sees happening around her. You start to sort of see, well, is it worth it? It's the the struggle inside her. And the scene is a particular scene where she actually goes to HR and says, hey, there's some funky shit going on. And at one point the HR guys, they're like, I've got hundreds of resumes from people just waiting to take your job. It's one of the most brilliant, sort of brilliantly sleazy depictions of HR. I mean, you've worked in large corporations before, you've dealt with HR before. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's worked in a large corporation knows that HR are not there to help you. They are not your friend. They might try and sell that shit to you, but they are not your friend. They are there to protect the company.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no more brilliant depiction of that than in this film, I think, where the HR guy, like I said, just starts out. He never directly says, you should shut your mouth and not say anything about that. But he does, if you know what I mean, right? Mm-hmm. He absolutely does say that to her. Yeah. But he never says it to her in so many words.
Mm.
And at the end, you can see the film if you want to see what actually happens to her complaint. But I can't say I enjoyed this film, but I can definitely say I would recommend this film.
Okay.
It does not have a particularly great IMDb rating. It has a 6, which I think is low. Not so many votes. I don't know how many people are seeing it. I don't know if it's been downvoted by men's rights activist Fox. There's a 79 Metacritic score. That's far more in line with what I would suspect. It's and maybe it's a 6 is because it's not it's there are no explosions and there are no superheroes involved.
Well, I was going to ask you this seems like the kind of perfect movie to be coming out at a point when no big movies are coming out. It's getting a little bit more of the limelight that this sort of theme for a movie is not exactly a summer blockbuster thing for sure. And it's dealing with a very hot button topic.
Very timely. There's been a lot of issue going on of late. If you're a Twitter user, I know about a week ago there was a wave of what some people are calling the professional wrestling's Me Too moment. So there have been a wave of allegations and revelations about some fairly well-known professional wrestlers in the United States for some pretty disgusting behavior. A number of them have been sacked. No one, I think, from the WWE, but at least one or two from from AEW have had to be moved on and be sacked.
Yep.
And lots of it locally here as well in Australia. So nowhere's immune from this kind of thing. But then again, I've also seen a whole lot of other stuff popping up recently about Twitch streaming and the games industry of people doing some pretty fucked up shit. So timely. I mean, it is a timely moment for a film like this to come out. I think it came out in the States maybe last year. I'm not sure, but it only came out in Australia in the last week, maybe so week or two. So you're right, and it's potentially people would see it because, as I said, I mean, Jaws and Jurassic Park are the number one films at the box office. So nothing else is coming out. So
yeah,
I hope more people get to see this. And it does make me think of we had this conversation a few weeks ago about when we were talking about the supposed new Star Wars series that they're going to produce.
Which
is being, the showrunner is Leslie Headland, who did Russian Doll. Leslie Headland was Harvey Weinstein's assistant.
Yep.
So actually she was, if you don't know who she is, look her up. She's very successful now. She's going to do a new Star Wars TV show.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying she did or knew anything untoward, but she did work for a creep. So, maybe this is something, maybe if you sort of think of her as one of the potential endpoints for Jane's character in The Assistant, potentially. Again, like I said, I don't know if she did anything wrong or illegal or did anything unethical. I don't want to get sued. I'm just saying, this is the kind of position someone working for a Harvey Weinstein before he was disgraced could potentially find themselves. So it was, if you think of this is one of it, if you're a young person with big dreams, you could have been doing big TV shows and movies and stuff like that. If you can see your way to sort of potentially, not noticing what's going on around you.
It's one of those disgusting cliches of particularly Hollywood, but in most industries, the idea of, well, you do really horrible shit for your boss who's generally going to be an asshole, and then eventually they die or they move on to another business and you can take over and you pay your dues. And it's a very old kind of way of thinking, and progressing. It's sort of like, yeah, I had to deal with this shit, so you will now. It's your turn to satisfy my every whim and do 176 hours a week and all that sort of stuff. But that's not actually the way that it needs to be, and it's certainly not the way that it should be, and especially not if you are making anyone feel uncomfortable or violated in any way, shape, or form.
Or you having have people like Jane's character in this is to basically shut up and ignore her conscience.
Yeah.
And yeah, to potentially lead other women into situations she knows are unsafe and, you know, unethical. So it's a real, real thought-provoking film. It's a conversation starter. Mm. If you're all interested in the topic, you know, it doesn't sound like, so you're right, it doesn't sound like your summer blockbuster fare. You're not going to want to walk out and buy the book. But, you know, these are the uncomfortable type of films that I think we need to see. These are the palate cleansers.
Yeah.
So you can go out and watch Endgame for the 73rd time afterwards if you want. But, you know, don't ignore little films like this. A little film that could.
Absolutely. Great. Yeah. Good. That's awesome to hear. That's awesome to hear.
Like I said, you can actually go to the cinema to see it.
Whether we can in a couple of weeks or not, that's up for debate at the moment.
Good news. Tenet's coming out at the end of July.
Yeah, I'm still not entirely believing that.
They're still promoting a 70mm version they'll be showing in July. We'll see.
Yeah. I am so curious about that movie.
I still say my favorite part of the Rise of Skywalker was the first 5 minutes of Tenet.
there's not too much to like in Rise of Skywalker, so that doesn't really set the bar high, but it's a Chris Nolan movie. He's not really made a bad movie yet. He's kind of...
Mission Impossible, whatever it was. We just like went to this IMAX cinema just so we could see the first 5 minutes of A Dark Knight Rises. Mission Impossible was the steak knives.
Yeah, I can't remember for the when they did the same thing for The Dark Knight. I think it might have been a Fast and the Furious movie or something in IMAX, and they had the first bit, and I went, I paid the ticket, and I watched the Batman sequence, and then I just got up and left, and the guys went, oh, yeah, you all right? So I'm like, yeah, I seen what I needed to see. And I literally just left after the 5 minutes.
Well, it's probably a good choice. I didn't mind the Mission Impossible film we saw, but...
yeah, it was all right.
Nice little tactic to see. The first 5 minutes, trust me, the first 5 minutes, I don't know if anybody else has seen it, but that 5 minute segment of Tenet that I saw was like, fuck, I need to see this fucking movie. I have a feeling it's going to be very good. But as you say, you know, like it's Chris Nolan. He hasn't really put a thought wrong. If the worst film you've ever made is Insomnia,
and that's it's been a pretty good career. Really? That's a good movie. It's a
good movie. I'm just saying, like it's just, you know, you made a list.
Yeah.
That or Interstellar. A lot of people didn't get Interstellar.
Some people aren't fans of The Prestige. Is it like, oh, yeah, it's his least interesting movie. I'm like, come on, it's got David Bowie in it. Shut up.
Yeah, if that's the worst film you've got your name on.
Yeah. There's not many out there who have got such a quality bracket as him and Quentin Tarantino, in all honesty.
No, it's rare. It's rare.
Yeah.
Guys who are pretty choosy about what they make, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
If you've got nothing to talk about, I can keep talking.
Well, I've not really had much time to really do much. I've invested about 50 hours so far into XCOM 2 on the Nintendo Switch. And
how do you find that?
I love it. I love turn-based games like that. Mario and Mario plus Rabbids was awesome a couple of years ago, and I got the DLC, and it was just fantastic, truly delightful. And it's a very Nintendo-fied XCOM light kind of thing. And XCOM is really frustrating in that sometimes you can just have really bad luck, and it's like, oh, you've got a 82% chance of making that shot. And it's like, how did you fucking miss? You're right in front of him.
Oh, God, you tear your hair out with those moments.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's just so good. And having it portable is just a joy, being able to just sit out in the back in the stock room and play for half an hour, or just lying in bed and playing. It's amazing, putting it up on the big screen, and it just still looks good. The visuals are no way near as good as what they are on Xbox, PlayStation, or PC, for obvious reasons, but they're good enough. And the core game mechanics, it's all there. The DLC is all there. It's really impressive. It's pricey on Switch. It's $90 over here, but it's a meaty package that you're getting, and it's really, really good fun. And the other thing that I bought that I have invested about 10 hours in, it does mean the death of this game, because it is an online game, ladies and gentlemen. It is Overwatch.
You gotta go. I think it's pretty safe, frankly, considering it's been around for 4 years now.
This will be a test. It's going to suddenly drop off a cliff. They're going to cancel Overwatch 2. Everyone's going to ask for their money back. The servers are just going to blow up. It is going to be Overwatch apocalypse.
Are you playing on Switch?
I am playing on Switch, and it's really nice because they've added the gyroscopic controls, so you've got more quick movement turning. It's obviously not as quick as a mouse and keyboard, but it's really nice and responsive, and it feels good. The artistic style of Overwatch lends itself very nicely to being sort of, the reduced resed, and it still looks nice. It plays super smooth. The online functionality is fully there. The whole game is there. There's nothing been cut out like a lot of previous Nintendo translated online games. It's a very good copy of the game, and it's very enjoyable overall. And the way that all of the different heroes play, I get why people get invested in it, because it's fun just seeing them. And like the character of McCree is voiced by Matthew Mercer, who does Critical Role, and I'm a big fan of that. So I said, like, ooh, that's fun. I have a Critical Role connection. That's good. And I think one of them is voiced by Mary Elizabeth McGlynn, who has cameoed and is part of the Critical Role family. So it's got those nice little niches. If you like your voice actors and stuff, there's a lot of voices you recognize in it. And everything is...
Who are you maining so far?
I'm generally going with... Moira?
Moira, okay, you're buying support.
Yeah, because Moira's abilities, I don't have to be ridiculously accurate with aiming or anything like that. I can heal a little bit. I can attack a little bit. She seems to be going quite good. I feel like I'm playing her relatively well.
You see her in most games.
Yeah.
So this is the point I've been trying to make to you since the game came out. You don't need to be fucking shit-hot Mr. Call of Duty, you know, Twitch shooter kind of guy to get along in Overwatch. There are other roles you can fill if you're like me, who sucks at first-person shooters. So, you know, that's why I'll play a Mercy, a Lucio, where, you know, I don't... My job is just to keep the team alive.
Yeah.
Largely. And, you know, the people who are good at shooting can shoot.
Yeah. It's also nice that they incentivize playing different role groups as well.
Has done it now. It didn't originally, but yeah, the way they've landed now is you get extra credits and stuff for playing a certain role. Yeah,
that's a great little extra feature for even for people who are sort of like maining DPS characters and stuff like that. It's like, okay, you know what? It'd be nice to get a couple of loot boxes, so I might as well try support. And all of the characters have got enough unique identification about them that it's like, okay, yeah, there's something fun about this one.
And so they've done really one thing that Blizzard, I mean, for all their faults, have done well in this game, is usually by the time a character lands in Overwatch proper, it feels like it's a pretty balanced character. Mm. They've been through playtesting quite a bit. They feel balanced. Occasionally they might be slightly OP or slightly underpowered, but they'll tweak it for a while. And so I guess the upside about you joining a game that's 4 years old now, Moira's been around for a couple of years, I think. She wasn't an original. But you know, they've had a couple of years to work out those kinks for a lot of those characters.
Yeah.
So the latest characters, maybe you might find them a little edgy still. But for the most part, though, you're playing one of, especially one of the original bunch of characters who landed when the game started. They've been through so many, you know, tweaks and bits and bobs now, but they've kind of got them so good. I enjoy it if nothing else because, you know, it's a nice to be able to jump in, you know, have a game for a while, then, you know, 20 minutes, half an hour, and then go do something else.
It's a nice kind of pick up and play game, I think, overall. There's obviously that level where if you want to just mainstream this game, you can become really fucking good at it. But if you want to just jump in, have a bit of fun and jump out, it's very accessible. The fact that you, while you're waiting for a game, you can go in and do practice and stuff. That's a nice little addition. And then it'll just go, oh, you're in the game. Here you go. And the fact that even during a match, it's like, oh, I'm dying. Even the characters are like, a new tactic might be advisable. It's like, yeah, okay, I'll try a different character.
And the game is designed for that. The idea is, I think the way the game was designed was, I'm getting my ass kicked.
Mm.
You know, switch to a different style of hero can actually completely, you know, tip the balance in your favor. If it's someone else is playing a Pharah, for example, who's a flying hero, you know, and your team is poorly equipped to attack somebody like that, one of your DPS characters is going to switch to a character who is, then, you know, they can quickly neutralize the advantage the other team had by their selection of hero. And then you can force them to maybe have a think about changing. So it's certainly, I mean, it's less important, I think, in the support space where you're playing. It is one of the things that people need to, one of the things the game tries to make you do is certain characters are better against certain types of tactics.
It's a really smartly balanced game, and certainly, you know, I've played Smash Brothers every iteration of it, and the amount of characters that they have in there and the different styles, and you, every time a new character gets put in, people go, oh, it's so OP and it's not well balanced, and it's sort of like, well, I can see why that's a long journey to get a character balanced, because no matter how much testing you do, everyone works that, especially when it gets into the pro level where it's like they're measuring the millisecond of movements and things like that. Like, yeah, it might not be that accurate, but the character works. Go play.
For example, so like when the game came out, I thought the characters were pretty well balanced, but you know, Mercy, for example, the character I made, her ultimate ability was to be able to resurrect players. Yeah, the whole idea was you got that maybe once or twice a game. And the way it used to work was you'd sort of wait until there was a whole bunch of people dead, and then you'd try to get in there quickly and use your ult to get four or five people up at once. That was fucking fun when you get four or five people up at once, you know. Then you got play of the game.
Yeah.
Even at the early time of going, you know what, that's not really working. It's not really you don't get to use it that much. You get to use it once every now and again. So, and like, you wouldn't res one player. If one player's down, it's not really worth it for one player. One or two, maybe two, three would be nice. So it wasn't really being used to its fullest ability. So they have changed that. That's not her ult now. That's like that ability is one of her abilities. Just has a 30-second cooldown, whereas her ult is something else. So, you know, as I said, you've got the great benefit of a game that's 4 years old, so it's really mature and really had a lot of balancing done over the years. At the same time, it's still got a really solid player base.
Yeah. I mean, like, there aren't too many games that are pushing 5 years old online that have still got that much. Like, even on Switch, the redheaded stepchild of the console online reliability, shall we say, spectrum, the time frame between matches is very short. It's great, and that's just because there are lots and lots of people playing it. It's wonderful.
I mean, Bloodborne might have, was it Bloodborne or Battleborne you played back in the day? Is the one
I waited 27 minutes for a match.
You know, it's like, it might have been a great fucking game. I heard good reviews. It was just a case of, it came out at exactly the same time as Overwatch.
Yeah.
And everybody chose the other one. So, you know, it's not to say that other games aren't good. It's just this is the one that got popular, and that's just where the players were. That's the reason, main reason I keep playing it is I can always get a match.
Yeah. And, you know, it was half price on the Nintendo Switch, and I was able to use my gold reward coins and get another. I paid for half of it with just because I've been buying stuff on eBay. So it ended up being $15 for me, or $12 or something like that. It was really minimal.
I'm almost tempted to get it on the Switch so I can actually finally play a game with you. But that said, I don't think I can get used to the gyroscopic controls. But
it's weird getting used to it. It's really weird because you start going around and, you know, it, especially if you're playing handheld, you're like this and then you start getting into it and you start leaning forward and you're like, why does it keep looking at the floor? It's like, oh, I'm looking at the floor. But it's fun. It's fun. It's enjoyable. I never said that it was going to be a shit game. But the real point of me bringing it up is actually because of the characters and because of the fantastic little short films that they produce every time they bring out characters, the story-based stuff. I went down the rabbit hole of watching all of those. And I would be so down for a TV series based in this world with these characters. Yeah, the characters are memorable, they're interesting, they're fun, they've built a lot of lore into those short stories, and it's ripe for that.
I'm honestly shocked I haven't got around to it, considering people are gagging for content now with all the different streaming services.
Yeah.
And you've got a massive, well, there was, and probably a smaller, but a massive player base of people who know these characters and love these characters. If you haven't already, I'll send you a link afterwards. There's a fantastic video of just the voice actors hanging around. They hang out together. They're all friends and stuff. And people love just watching the voice actors hang out and do their lines and stuff. And so these are beloved characters now many years on. So it's been, maybe it's a bit like Nintendo where with Mario, right? Like maybe Blizzard has gone, hang on, everybody who's come to us with a proposition has been garbage. We're not going to let just anybody, you know, have it get their hands on the golden goose here. It's got to be quality. Maybe that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe. But I think it's a matter of when, not if, for something like that. And I'm all for it. I think it will be a really entertaining, interesting. And if they keep if they can keep the quality of those short films, it's going to look great.
Yeah. I feel like they've maybe they've missed their moment.
Maybe, but they could also time it with the release of Overwatch 2 or something like that, and catch a whole new wave.
So I've been playing a little game. I got a couple we're going to talk about probably next week when I got some more time on it. But I have picked up a new game for my Oculus Quest. That is, and this is quite a good one, actually. I find it hard to really get into a lot of the Oculus games. I sort of play them for an hour or so and go, yeah, it's all right. You know, this one, though, is called Torva Saves the Universe.
Torva Saves the Universe, okay.
Yes. And it is created by and voiced by Justin Roiland. Of course, for those who don't know, Justin Roiland is one of the creative forces behind Rick and Morty.
Rick and Morty,
A lot of the voices for Rick and Morty is Rick and Morty voices. on the show, I think he's a writer as well, but don't quote me on that. It's a really interesting little platform puzzler game. Okay. You play Torva, who is a Catcharian, who basically is a race of people who live on chairs
and don't walk.
So what's wonderful about this game is it has a nice little move mechanic. So one problem with a lot of VR games is if you're moving on rails, your character's moving in game when you've got the headset on.
Yeah.
And your character starts moving, you can kind of get a little bit queasy, right? Because your body says it's not moving, but your brain says, yes, you are moving.
Yeah.
So that could be a little awkward, but this one's kind of cool. So they've got what they call teleporter pad sort of thing. So you're teamed up with another character just voiced by Justin Roiland, who you can have a little control pad. Your character in the game has a control pad. And okay. You can make him run around, and you can make him run around and stand in like a portal. Then you click the trigger, and you just transport to that portal where he is. So that's your way of moving around the levels using these portal and transporter portals. Mm. And essentially, you're a character who is out walking his dogs all day, and of course, a giant monster came along and started to kidnap your dogs and inserted them into his empty eye sockets, which gave him the power of a god who he now wants to use to take over and destroy the universe.
Absolutely so logical.
Clocon is the big monster, I think it's called.
Okay.
And so you're like ostracized by the community because like it's your dogs that are now leading to the end of the world. and so this character, I forget the character's name, but the purple, really cool purple character that you control turns up to sort of help you, try and take down Glorkon and rescue your dogs. And so you control this character who sort of jumps around the environment and that's how you move, and you sort of you can sort of destroy parts of the environment to find collectibles and power ups and that kind of thing. You're constantly sort of a little Easter eggs hidden around the levels. You're trying to catch things like called green power babies. The collectibles sort of help you upgrade your character.
Okay.
Your character art, as I sort of said, it's a platform puzzler. So you're sort of jumping across platform system to try and get to the next teleporter portal so you can move your character there. And there's some really interesting movement characteristics where you can actually make your chair jack up or jack down, so you can sort of get a sort of a bird's eye view of what's going on. Can be the easiest way just to control your character to make sure he's not getting killed and get to the next thing. Nice little puzzle sections where what's sort of really funny is like one section we got to click keys or buttons, and he's like, oh man, like it's just really lazy development. All you're doing is clicking buttons. This isn't fun. This isn't cool. Maybe there's a guide online. Go online and see if you can find out what to do online. it's really self-aware of what it's doing. It knows it's a game, right? I mean, like you said, platforming is fun.
Yeah.
And it's fun. And it's enjoyable. It's the dialogue that makes this thing, man. It's all about dialogue. You're laughing all the way through or snickering or grinning. Like, it's classic Justin Roiland. I mean, they're all the characters. I mean, one thing about him is all his characters sound like Rick and Morty. And so, he doesn't do many voices. But it's still fun. It's the amount of dialogue that's been inserted into the game.
Yeah.
So the game and the dialogue reacts, the characters react differently, and they give different dialogue depending on what your character does.
Oh, so it's a little bit borderline Stanley Parable?
A little bit, yeah. Okay. And sometimes you sort of stand around. Like, I find myself just standing around, listening to characters talk to each other. it's not like they say the same three or four things. They'll just have a natural conversation about something. Ridiculous, of course, because it's just in the boiling. You know, like, oh man, I can't wait to take my pants off and do, it's ridiculous. it's disgusting. It's, this is not a game for children. Bots, if you're out there, you do not buy this for your children.
You do not buy your baby calculators.
There are lots of F-bombs and stuff that you do not want your children listening to.
Mm-hmm.
That said, for a grown-ups, if you like that Rick and Morty-style comedy, I think you'll enjoy this. I think this is a perfect example of a game where the writing... I don't know if it's writing. I never know with Justin Roiland. It kind of sounds like he's improvising half the time, right? It's not like really clear delivery. It's that stulted sort of half improv,
It's style. Probably kind of like that, where it is just chicken scratch and doodles.
I'm kind of anxious here, man. Like, you don't have to talk to me like that, man. Like, you're making me feel kind of shit here, man.
You could have a career in Rick and Morty.
I don't know if that's just his shtick, or he actually just gets into a booth and they say, okay, you're meeting three giant aliens, go.
Yeah.
And I guess they record. I wouldn't be surprised if that's what it does, but, you know, what do they write? Do they do the animations? Do they, however they do it, that the actual dialogue and the writing is so good and it's so funny and so enjoyable that, like, you just want to be in this world for as long as possible. And like I said, how often in a game do you just stop and listen to a couple of characters having a ridiculous conversation and enjoy every second of it?
Yeah.
And want to come back and do the level again later so you can do it differently just to see what the different dialogue is.
I think the only other kind of games that have ever really been mentioned for that kind of thing is like GTA or Red Dead Redemption and that sort of stuff, where it's like, oh yeah, I'm just going to stand here and just, you know, watch people walk down Main Street having a conversation.
It's a fair point. I think it's a bit different to that in the sense it's like, you get some random shit can kind of happen in those games. But it's a lot of fun. This game is available on PSVR. I believe it came out about a year ago now.
Okay.
PlayStation VR. Mm-hmm. So I think it's on most VR platforms now. That's what I've read. It's quite a new addition to the Oculus stable. So it's about $30 or $40. So you know, expensive-ish. I don't know how long. I'm told it's sort of your 5 to 10 hour range sort of game. I do always say it's like, I hope that they do more of this kind of thing. I know there have been some VR games for Rick and Morty which have been kind of meh. But I would love to see a game like this in the Rick and Morty universe. That could be a game like this with that property could be the killer app that VR wants. Because sometimes that's the problem with VR is, you know, the games are okay, but they're not great.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of VR stuff is experiential, and we're still, even though it's I paused to say that it's mainstream, but it's never been more mainstream than it is now, and it is getting more popular, but we're still in that experimental phase of, we don't really know how to actually translate games, like when Nintendo just went, oh yeah, by the way, we are mass producing a completely successful platformer style game with Super Mario 64, and we've completely changed the environment of computer games. This is the next evolution to that. It's sort of like, yeah, this is how we do games now. There's not that kind of standard format, and people are doing like these teleport spots to help with the sickness, and some people are using the VR more as like a camera thing, and you're still controlling the character on screen a bit more traditional gamepad style. It's going to be interesting to see how it evolves.
But the new Star Wars X-Wing, cross, you know, the flight
suit. Oh, yes, I saw.
It's going to be on VR. So I'm kind of curious to see how that looks, because I could think, on the one hand, it could look really cool in VR, but the other hand, I'm like, it could also, motion sickness could be a real problem.
Yeah, because not only is it I hope it's going to be fast action, you know, space battles, but also, yeah, you are moving around, and not only are you doing sort of like up, down, left, and right, but you're barrel rolling.
I don't know how that's going to work. It'll be interesting to see how they do it.
It's going to be fun.
It's going to be interesting to see. But yeah, you're right. No one's quite got it right. But if you have a VR headset, or you are thinking of getting one, or you know someone who's got one, Torvus Ames the Universe is probably, I would say, other than Beat Saber, the best game I've played on VR today.
Okay. All right. Good to know. Anything else you want to talk about, or should we wrap up the show for this week?
I'll wrap up a show, a quick one this week, just because we don't have a whole lot of content this week. But next week or the week after, whenever time allows, we'll be back and we will talk about the King of Comedy.
Yes. And I will make sure that I have more things to talk about. I have just started because Netflix are apparently doing a bit of a push on more anime, and they've got the first 4 seasons of One Piece on there. And I just saw today that they have now got Food Wars on there as well. So I am looking forward to that. So I'll talk about that stuff.
I just started a series on SBS On Demand called Future Man. which is in produced by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, so it's bad guys. Watch one episode. Not really quite ready to share an opinion yet, but I hopefully will get a couple more episodes in time and give a more well-rounded update on whether it's something worth watching.
Cool. Cool. Well, on that note, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us and this video, because things went kind of haywire. Obviously, we're not live anywhere, but this will get added onto YouTube and then Facebook later on. And hopefully next week we should be back to our live broadcast thing. And we will be on podcast again as soon as I actually have a moment to upload shit. So, yay! Reality is slowly coming back to my world. Yeah.
On that note, shall we say good night, people? Good night, bots.
Good night, bots. 10001100110012.
Yeah, you say that.
Good night.
make up your mind in a space that's right. Fish through honey, it doesn't move as slow. Time's a waste, covered in dust. You're always the last to know. I don't need, a hesitant man. I don't need, a hesitant man. Leave me alone, your best defense. This facade is beginning to show. So many holes in these curtains. Why am I always the last to know? Make a decision, don't trip and fumble.